chase the sunlight mile after mile. And I feel like I know this place as a tree line breaks in the wide open space.
Hi, everyone. This is Gary welcoming you to the LL Research Radio Program In the Now, Q&A with Carla and crew. Today is Monday, June 23rd, 2014. Carla L. Record is an author, mystic seeker, and primary channel for LL Research. The crew in the title refers to those of us at the LL Center, beginning with Jim McCarty, Carla's husband, scribe for the Raw Contact, and president of LL Research. Austin and I, devoted seekers of the Law of One, manage LL from the home office. LL Research is a nonprofit organization dedicated to freely sharing spiritually oriented information and fostering community. And towards this end has two websites, the archive website, llresearch.org, and the community website, bringforth.org. We will be discussing questions that come from you. If you would like to ask us a question live on the air, please call 646-595-2294 and press the 1 key when prompted. If interested in submitting a question when we're not on air, please visit our show's webpage at blogtalkradio.com/llresearch. When submitting questions, please remember that this is a Law of One Q&A. Try to keep your questions as spiritually oriented as possible. Again, I'm Gary, and we're talking with Carla L. Ruckert and the home crew of LL Research. How is everybody today?
We'd be fine.
Very good.
Glad to be here.
Wonderful.
All right, then we'll move forward into the opening quote that comes from December 16, 1990. Quo says, "We welcome you to an infinitely long path, to a path that is rocky, a path that each walks, but yet a path in which there are companions along the way that make every step of the journey sweet and beautiful in their sharing. My friends, love one another. There is no greater wisdom for you than this. This is the choice that you make in every moment of your experience. It is for this that you came here, to make this choice in such a firm way that you discover that the feet upon which you stand are made of light, and the rock upon which you build is as firm as eternity. May you build to eternity."
Thank you, Gary. May you build to eternity. How many of us really believe that we can do that? I do, but it's taken me years. I mean, years. I always thought I would be helping person or persons. You know, I thought small. I wanted to be the matriarch of a big family that lived in the country and had a garden and some farm animals that gave us milk and so forth. And I just thought that that would be a wonderful way to live. And, of course, I was expecting somebody to volunteer for the position of the guy that supports this dream. I never got that. But I thought small. I was serving a few people, and that was plenty for me. And then when I was able to get hold of energy enough to create L&L Research, it changed for me. I realized that although in myself I couldn't do anything, through me, energies that would help many people. And certainly I've had many people say that the channeled information has helped them greatly and even transformed many a life. And that's wonderful to hear. I love hearing that. It just makes my day every time. I really did serve. I really did help somebody. That just thrills me no end. Anyway. But building to eternity. I don't know. It took me a long time for that one to sink in. That we could, by choosing to love in every circumstance that we met in life, build to eternity. Not only help one person or a few people or serious seekers, but globally. The energy of the planet, after all, is a conglomeration of all of us, and certainly it's a mixed up, messed up conglomeration at this point, but not as much as it was 30 years ago when I began this work and nobody was interested in what we were doing. Now we have lots of people that are digging it and understanding it and thanking us for it, and it's, you get the feeling of just the beginning of an explosion of people who are waking up. Whether they choose us or someone else is just not important to me. The fact is that they're choosing to wake up. They're choosing to seek. They're choosing to look and see if they can find some help in creating a spiritual path that builds to eternity. Oh, my. This is big. This is huge. This is wonderful. And it's really happening. It really is. When I began, I was able to take care of all of L&O's business myself. My husband took care of the yard, and it's stupid to call it a yard. It's a garden, a front garden, a side garden, a back garden. And he worked on that constantly and helped me in the office to a certain extent, but for the most part it was on me. And I was able to do it. I was able to do the correspondence involved, the bookwork, you know, having to do with finances, all of that. And this went on that way for quite a number of years. And then I guess about 10 years ago, it started to swell. And suddenly I was jam-packed in the office. I didn't know what I could do to get it all done. And it was very seldom that I did get it done. I was just desperate, and Gary stepped up and volunteered to try to make some sense out of what I was not getting to. And then as the years went by, he got busier and busier, and finally he said, look, I need somebody in the office. I can't get to everything. So that's the way it's been. It's been an explosion enough to take up the energies of three people instead of one. And let me tell you, I got a lot done. Gary gets a lot done. I mean, this is not people slacking off. This is people working at least 9 to 5, if not 9 to 9. When you count the website and all of it that entails, and when you count answering every single piece of email or snail mail that comes our way, which we still do. We don't let anybody go unanswered. It's very important to us. And yet we are building to eternity with L&O Research. I am confident of that now. And it's very inspiring to know that. We have finally gotten it through our heads. This is a spiritual endeavor. That our choices are made in light. They mean something. Not just to us, but to the planet. Because this is what we came here to do more than anything else. This is what we came to do, simply to make space in our lives for the vibration of love. And when we are trying to serve people and to take the high road when there is a difficult choice to make, see it. I mean, everybody's high road is somewhat different. We have moved over into spiritual endeavor, and we are building light bricks in that wonderful place, one way or another, to live with love in our lives, in our choices, in all that we think, do, and say. You can do the same. I'm not special. I certainly had a special body of material in the material that Jim, Don, and I created in the early 80s. And that has been the foundation of our work always, the raw material. But I have channeled also in conscious channeling for many years and have hundreds, if not over 1,000 channelings that we've preserved. I'm sure I have more than that, actually. In the early days, we would reuse tapes, so we only got the last tape that I recorded in the early days before we started saving all tapes. That's expensive, you know, when you're doing this thing all by yourself, you know, you think of these things. But we finally took the step and took the bite, Don and I, and decided that we were going to keep all the tapes, because I wasn't getting to them. I wasn't able to type them up as fast as I was producing them. For a long time, though, several years, we had channelings. We had a meeting every day at someone's house, either at ours or elsewhere. And so it was from that period that I say I couldn't keep up. So maybe I'm talking to the choir. Maybe I'm saying things that you already know. But that's fine, too. It may be something you haven't actually gotten hold of yet, and I hope you do. It's very inspiring to realize that in one small life, by the choices you make, you can build a spiritual structure that will last forever. Of your simple choices, good, bad, yes, no, I hope you do it.
Amen. Thank you so much, Carla. We will move into our first question today that comes from Klaus, sent via email. Klaus asks, personally, I've been very skeptical about this, quote, holy bond of marriage throughout my short life. I'm 26. It has never really made sense to me, as I felt that unconditional love is something both state and religious authority should keep their noses out of, not to mention dedicating yourself to someone for the rest of your life, knowing that everybody changes. Nevertheless, I've begun to see the positive aspects of it, as I am, since a few years, in a beautiful and magical relationship, which only keeps on growing towards the positive the more I dedicate myself to both her and our relationship. In this regard, Carla and Quo do make sense to me. But so do Ra when they say, this comes from Session 31, Question 16, I am Ra. The racial memory contains all that has been experienced. Thus there is some, shall we say, contamination, even of the sexual, this showing mostly in your own culture as the various predispositions to adversary relationships, or, as you call them, marriages, rather than the free giving one to another in the love and the light of the one infinite creator. Klaus closes by saying, if marriage is contamination, can it still be in accordance with a life true to the law of one?
Jim and I are the only married couple in the group, and unless Jim wants to take this question first.
I'll give it just a little bit of a shot.
All right.
I'll give it a skeleton. You can put some flesh on it. I think that you can do whatever you want to in a marriage or in a married relationship. I think what I was talking about was a general run of things over the course of human history where the marriage relationship is one where the male is classically the head of the family and the strong and goes out and does things and conquers the world and drags the woman back from the cave and she's home and raises the kids and all of that stuff. And I think that results in the adversary relationship because the woman is a human being too, and that deep part of her that wishes to express itself as freely as does the male is probably very unhappy with not being able to do that, and thus has set up a very basic adversary relationship where the rights are being taken away and freedom of will is not experienced. So I think that when you decide that you want to be in a relationship with someone else, it's really up to you to make the boundaries or to describe the field upon which the crop will be sown. how far should we go with this metaphor? anyway, so that's basically what I wanted to say, Rob.
Okay. Well, I'll just tell the story as I see it. And Jim, you correct me if I have it wrong, of our relationship, and talk about the relationship in general from there. When Jim and I married in 1987, I was absolutely crazy about the guy. He was not crazy about me. He actually had all the deep stuff. He respected me. He honored me. He thought what I was doing with my life was absolutely tops. And he wanted to help. He has always wanted to help. That's Jim's definition of our relationship. He wants to help me in whatever way I see fit. Well, of course, I couldn't ask him to fall in love with me. That just wasn't going to happen. So I didn't, and I suffered, and it was hard because I didn't have any of the stuff that you get on the surface of things. You know, none of the sweet talk, none of the hugging, none of the kisses on the way out the door. It was just a solid friendship, a job that we had in common, building to eternity as we both believed that we were. And that was it. We didn't have the things that make an adversary relationship because by Jim's own definition of that, I was expressing myself fully and had no gripe. I had no gripe at all, except that I wished to heck that he'd fall in love with me. And he didn't, and he continued not to, and we went from the 80s into the 90s, and it was, I guess, about 10 years of marriage. And one day I saved his life because I just did. I was swimming and I shoved him into shore and in the process shoved myself out into a riptide. And there I was sort of sailing off to, I don't know, what's on the other side of the ocean there. I was sailing off towards it anyway. And it was going to be a long ride unless somebody came and got me because I swear I could not get out of that thing. And I tried swimming, and that I couldn't. I mean, if you've ever experienced a riptide, there's no way you can swim your way out of it. You have to swim diagonally to the riptide, which I never knew. I'd never heard of one. I never knew what they were. Of course, I was trying to swim into shore, and that was not diagonal to the riptide's direction. And consequently, I couldn't get out of it. Okay, so I decided I would just float. I'm very good at floating and probably would preserve my energy the most by not moving around at all. And I did that. I floated on my tummy for a few minutes. It wasn't very long, actually. It felt like a decade or so. But it actually wasn't very long. It was probably 10 or 15 minutes. And then I had a huge wave throw me into shore. I guess a wave from spirit, you'd have to say, and I was never so thankful. And I staggered out of the drink, very, very grateful. And I started noticing Jim's change in behavior when he was laughing at my bad jokes. I mean, I don't make very many good ones, but I love to make a joke, so I make a lot of bad puns. He was laughing at them. He never had before. He might groan. For the most part, he tried to ignore them. He was not a bad critic, a good critic, but, you know, he wasn't kind. And all of a sudden, he was being very kind and going along with whatever silly idea I had. And this wasn't like him. His behavior was altered, and you know, all of a sudden, and I finally asked him what was going on, and he said, "You saved my life." And then he said, "You saved my life." And then he said, "You saved my life." And he kept repeating that for a couple of days, and I was like, I did what I thought I should do. I didn't think about saving a life. I didn't think about losing mine. I just thought this is what needed to be done. That's all. I was just doing what needed to be done, and I always do that. He said, yeah, but you saved my life. He just kept on, and I couldn't get him off of it. And I decided I didn't want to. I liked hearing that. Well, it turned out that he'd fallen in love with me that day. Wow. So we built anew the superstructure, not the basics, not the essence, not the reason people get married when they, the reason people should get married. Probably up into the material of the reason people do get married, for the most part, that they've fallen in love with each other. And truly, falling in love is not necessarily for a lifetime. If you fall in love with things that change about that person, when that person changes, your feelings are going to change. You don't have the capacity to love more than you did unless somehow you see more than you did in that person. We have many layers in our personalities and in our essential character. Jim fell in love with my character, if you want to say he fell in love with something, devoted to me as a spiritual seeker, and we were companions in that. And he was absolutely determined to help me in whatever way I wanted to make L&L work. He was willing to help. And only later, did he add the things that I was hungry for but did not think were important enough to fuss with, because I too wanted a companion more than I wanted the romance. More than anything, I wanted a companion for my deepest soul, and Jim has always been that. So that's the story of our relationship, and that's the reason that we haven't changed in our devotion to each other. It's grown, it's gotten beautiful, and it keeps getting more beautiful. But it stays the same, too. Jim's still trying to help me with anything that I need, and we're still trying to do the best we can to have our part in building L&L Research and making that material available to as many people as possible. Basically, we're both still working for Don Elkins, the third member of our original research. He asked me to do that, and I became determined to do that. When he died, of course, it made it much bigger in my mind that he'd asked me to spiritual center and to work in it, and I have done that, and Jim has done that. And we are so happy that he asked us to do that. I don't know how well we've done it, but we gave it our best shot. Guys, have at it. I know there's much more to say about marriage than I have said.
I wanted to take and there is a lot more to be said about marriage for sure. It's something myself I'm on the verge of. I will get married later this year to the love of my own life, eagerly and enthusiastically. I wanted to examine the question of how Ra describes, how do I want to say this, another example of something that, I want to highlight an example whereby a positive entity can do positive work in what seems like a negative structure. In The Law of One Material, Ra talks about the elder race, this group who, at the end of the minor cycle 25,000 years ago, apparently were harvestable, and they could have moved on to the next density, could have graduated, but instead they chose to stay with this planet. They thus became members of the elder race. And in Session 22, the questioner says, were any of these entities names that we know from our historical past? that have appeared as incarnated beings we find in our history. And Ra responds, the one known as Sound Vibration Complex Saint Augustine is of such a nature. The one known as Saint Teresa of such a nature. The one known as Saint Francis of Assisi is of such a nature. These entities, being of monastic background, as you would call it, found incarnation in the same type of ambiance appropriate for further learning. So these three individuals were members of what we call the Catholic Church in one form or another. And if you consider the history of the Catholic Church, any cursory examination of that organization will quickly reveal service to others aspects existing side by side with very service to self aspects. As an institution, the Church historically has sought to, as Ra described of the negative polarity, quote, benefit from fear. It frequently exercised control and domination on many levels, political control, religious control, control of thought, and control of behavior. Its sins, to use their terminology, are legion. Yet we're all aware of entities doing and having done very positive work through this institution, including those that Ra mentioned, those who are considered saints nowadays. And in session 60, question 18, Ra goes on to say, each of your orthodox religious systems, have all become somewhat mixed in orientation, yet offer a pure path to the one creator, which is seen by the pure seeker. So, likewise with marriage, I see marriage as something that's, like Jim was getting at, something that's been abused for a long time. It's not been historically a positively oriented, free-giving, free-receiving sort of thing. In general, of course, there's a lot of diversity and a lot of ways that cultures have chosen to do the bonding and mating thing. Most marriages, I think it's safe to say in general, didn't happen for reasons of love, but rather reasons of security or money or procreation or political alliance, etc. So Ra talks about the experience in third density that we entities have, that these experiences and these choices and what we do filters down into our collective mind and creates layers of bias. And they say of marriage that this has filtered into the racial or maybe even planetary memory and created predispositions that, in my interpretation, creates a sort of template of what marriage is and how it should be used and what the roles of the two partners are. And that filtering from all those years of abuse has created a template sort of ownership of the other self or power over the other self. As Ra said, quote, there is some, shall we say, contamination. And that has predisposed human beings to forming, quote, adversarial relationships, or as you call these, marriages. But this is, I think I'm reiterating what Jim's point was, is that just as the example of the church points out, even seemingly negative structures don't need to stop the student of positive polarity from practicing and deepening their polarity. And marriage offers one of those roads. Ra says elsewhere, in a couple different places, session 83, question 3, that in the third density, entities are attempting to learn the ways of love. If it can be seen that all are one being, it becomes much more difficult for the undisciplined personality to choose one mate and thereby initiate itself into a program of service. It is much more likely that the sexual energy will be dissipated more randomly without either great joy or great sorrow, depending from these experiences. So here Ra is saying that there is benefit to spiritual evolution to choose one mate and, as they say, initiate oneself into a program of service. Not that that's a uniform rule that applies equally to everybody in every circumstance, et cetera, but it seems that there's a more efficient use of catalysts in that regard or greater possibilities for evolution. And elsewhere in session 84, question 22, Ra is describing the learning gleaned from previous octaves of creation. And they say, it was determined after observation of the process of many logoi that polarization increased manyfold if the mating were not indiscriminate. Consequent logi thusly preserved a bias towards the mated relationship, which is more characteristic of more disciplined personalities and of what you call higher densities. So my take on that is that a marriage, or at least we'll call it a mated relationship because marriage has connotations of the legal contract that we know today, but the lifetime mated relationship, ideally by free choice, is a very positive road and offers a strong way to the positive polarity. But as it's been used on this planet, marriage has this quote-unquote contamination. That's where I'll stop for now.
In looking at Klaus's question, I see he uses the word state and religious authority should keep their noses out of it. So when I was thinking about this, I was thinking both along the lines of how a monogamous relationship in general could be beneficial to spiritual evolution, but also the idea of allowing a state-sanctioned relationship and how that would be either positive or negative. And I think it's an understandable sentiment given the nature of our current state and religious authorities, that there's sort of a rejection of government and religion and something that seems so sacred between two people. Our present government and religious institutions have given us sort of a bad taste, basically, as Gary and Jim were talking about, especially with religion, is marriage has not been something positive historically, necessarily. But I don't necessarily think, and especially nowadays, that bringing a personal romantic relationship to the level of being recognized on the societal level is in itself a bad thing. It allows us to integrate the deep bond of this romantic love into yet another part of our being, which is the societal self or the social self. And that's commonly associated with the yellow ray. And within the yellow ray, we find our social identity. It's sort of our interface to society. It's the way that we as a person relate to society and the way that society relates to us. And in marriage, we're a state-sanctioned marriage. We are expressing to society that this is now part of our identity. And to allow the state to recognize that officially is sort of allowing a type of reciprocation from society to acknowledge that the society will now recognize that is who you are in your identity. And I think that in this sort of reciprocation, there's a cycle of completeness and an expression of recognition, and that the bond between two people can be made even stronger in that yellow ray, and that a positive individual can crystallize their yellow ray even more through allowing sort of a state-recognized relationship. But I don't think it's necessarily necessary. It was redundant. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's necessary, but I do think that it's a ritual and a type of expression that can be beneficial as long as it's intended to be that way.
Jim and or Carla, what would you guys say have been the benefits for spiritual evolution in your own married relationship?
Well, the fact that we're both interested in spiritual evolution is really handy. So many people that we're familiar with over the years who read the Law of One information have said that they have to study it on their own. Not only is there no one in the area to talk to, there isn't anybody in their relationship. The husband or the wife is not interested. The best they can do is just accept their spiritual journey. So the fact that we're both interested in it and we're both supporting each other, and hopefully, besides having the open heart where we're willing to share what we feel, we also can share what we think in way of how we can do things better or hone our intentions or, you know, whatever our goals are, we can reflect them to each other and help each other out. So it's just that synchronicity, the synchronicity and harmony that come together and make it I guess Carlos over the years said like a dance, and I think that's right. We dance our way to spiritual eternity, I guess you'd say. Ruck, how about you? What do you think?
Well, you pretty well said it. The incredible advantages of having the person in your married relationship that not only tolerates the law of one material, but is part of it and has been part of developing it, has meant more to me than all the romance in the world. And, you know, I made a choice when I decided to marry Jim. I gave up having a family. I gave up having somebody that would be in love with me and massage those things that women so dearly love in the way of tender or sweet nothings. And I love yous over the crowded room and all that romantic stuff. I gave it up. I absolutely gave it up. And if Jim had decided that he wanted to go elsewhere for sexual satisfaction, I would have allowed it. I would have not only allowed it, but supported it. Because our relationship was like that. Our relationship was like whatever it takes for you to be yourself, I want to support that, whatever it is. And Jim felt the same to me. I mean, he couldn't change the way he felt about me, but he could change the way he supported me. And the support and the ability to discuss things is incredibly powerful. It's so important, and you know, it all comes at a very deep level. We're always dealing at a very deep level when we're working with our spiritual, and even when we're just having a regular conversation, it redounds to the spirit. And being in love hasn't changed that. So I guess that I would have to say what Jim said, you know, but with underlinings and asterisks and fleur-de-lis and all the things that I add, because I'm a girl and I like girly things. But it basically comes to the same. To be supported on that deep level, have that support, and to be able to support someone that you believe in totally. Oh, my God, that's huge. How many people do you believe in totally? You know? Oh, yeah. To have that benefit is worth all of the sacrifice I could ever think of. And I certainly gave it my all, you know, even when my heart was breaking. So there you go.
So even though you entered what Austin was describing as the yellow ray social contract of marriage, you didn't feel you had to conform to what Ra called that contamination of the mind. You still retained and even deepened your polarity by finding ways to give each other freedom and
yes.
to support one another as you are without...
Yes.
Right.
And if that had included breaking the relationship, then we would have supported that. But thank God it never did.
What you guys are describing about sharing your spirituality brought into mind Ra's mention of extravagant opportunities. So I ran a keyword search and found it. Ra and Don were discussing life before and after the veil, and Ra was talking about once the veil was instituted, or rather Don wanted to know once the veil was put into place,
mm-hmm.
then how did people penetrate the veil? And in part, in the course of responding, Ra said, in general, we may say that by far the most vivid and even extravagant opportunities for the piercing of the veil are a result of the interaction of polarized entities. Don follows up and says, what do you mean by interaction of polarized entities? And Ra says, we shall state two items of note. The first is the extreme potential for polarization in the relationship of two polarized entities which have embarked upon the service to others' path, or in some few cases, the service to self path. Secondly, we would note that effect which we have learned to call the doubling effect, those of like mind which together seek shall more surely find. And it sounds like that's what you guys have made or have manifested in your relationship and your marriage.
Right.
Yes.
Definitely.
Any further thoughts? Anybody?
I'm done.
Nope.
All right. Well, it is, we have about 17 minutes and we had a caller. No callers there any longer. All right, we'll move along to the next question.
We're sorry about the person who called and couldn't get on.
Yeah, feel free to call us back. Next week we'll be on air Wednesday instead of Tuesday. So our next question submitted prior to the show, let's go to Jamie's question. Jamie L. via Facebook writes, I'm curious about the densities. It is clear that first and second density are nested perfectly within third density. I don't remember reading about any of the lower densities coexisting within fourth density. Does the density of love and understanding blend with any of the lower densities? I remember reading that third density has about 100 to 700 years left, depending upon the ease of the transition. I am curious about what 4D is like without the lower densities. What do they eat? I deeply appreciate these Q&As. Light and love.
Well, I'll say one thing, and then I'll turn it over to Jim and anybody else, because Jim is so good with saying a lot in a little time. The densities remain. All the densities remain. In seventh density, you have nested within that all of through 1 through 6. Jim?
You're done?
Yeah.
Okay, that was a surprise. Yeah, well, I would agree that all the densities do exist together. Some are activated and some are not activated. Right now it looks like we have 1 through 4 activated. Then Ra suggested that until the new fourth density population is able to learn how to shield itself from being seen by third density, that there won't be a third density. But it'll still be possible, and at some point will be again inhabited.
Won't be a fourth density?
No, it won't be a third density.
It won't be a third density. Okay.
There'll be a fourth density that's learning how to be fourth density. Once they're pretty good at that and they're can shield themselves from the sight of third density, then I would guess at that time then third density could once again begin cycling on the planet. But, yeah, they all exist together, and I believe that since that's true, that we are able to be visited by entities from other densities and learn through whatever type of contact they have with us. I don't think I've got anything else to say. We move the cat off the paper.
I've got the rock quote that basically says exactly what you're saying.
Okay, why don't we read that then?
That is in session 62, question 29. Ra says, you must see the Earth, as you call it, as being 7 Earths. There is red, orange, yellow, and there will soon be a completed green color vibratory locus for fourth density entities, which they will call Earth. During the fourth density experience, due to lack of development of fourth density entities, the third density planetary sphere is not useful for habitation, since the early fourth density entity will not know precisely how to maintain the illusion that fourth density cannot be seen or determined from any instrumentation available to any third density. Thus, in fourth density, the red, orange, and green energy nexi of your planet will be activated, while the yellow is in potentiation, along with the blue and the indigo. So we've got basically all of the different densities at least in potentiation, and then once we get to fourth density, we will still have the first and second density here on Earth, and I'm no doubt that as fourth density beings, we'll be able to interact with them if we want to. And then once we figure out as a fourth density social memory complex how to hide ourselves from third density, then Earth will again support third density, it seems like.
I think we probably add that the reason fourth density does not want to be seen by third density is because it would influence and infringe upon the third density free will, give them the sure knowledge that, well, yes, there is more to life than you imagine, and that you probably ought to drop all thoughts that there aren't. And, third density needs to go through all the thoughts that it has, whether they're true or not.
I always thought that it was because in fourth density they don't have clothes, they're naked all the time, so they want to stay out of sight.
Jamie also asks if it's necessary to eat food, or she asks about food. And they discussed that in session 43. Don actually asks specifically, is it necessary to eat food in fourth density? And Ra says, I am Ra, this is correct. But luckily they go on to explain. They talk about the social catalyst due to eating and discuss how fourth density goes about it. Ra says that the fourth density being desires to serve, and the preparation of foodstuffs is extremely simple due to increased communion between entity and living foodstuff. The fact that Ra says living foodstuff makes me think that maybe they are still eating second density, probably plant matter, I'm assuming, but it seems like fourth density still does prepare and eat foodstuffs. where I believe Ross said that Fifth Density was able to sort of manifest their own broth, their own food to eat. So that is what Fourth Density eats.
No more McDonald's.
Yeah.
No, don't say that. My lunches are gone. I like fish sandwiches.
They're very strict about trans fats in Fourth Density.
Why? They're naked. What do they care about trans fats?
Maybe that's why. He's going to show a lot more.
Okay, we're joshing here. If you can't tell that we're joshing, you're in deep trouble because half of what we're saying is totally untrue. Okay. just having fun.
It is comforting to think, especially for those positively oriented on this planet who see the ongoing destruction of the biosphere and the extinction of species and life under threat here. It's comforting to think that in the new fourth density sphere will coexist with first and second density. So that means there will be a continuation of second density life and first density life. So
yes.
In my imagination, I like to believe that animal populations will rebound, forests will regrow, nature will find its new balance again, minus the third density cancerous activities of third density entities. So I think, have we wrapped that question up?
Yep.
All right. Let's see. Folk Love asked a question I'm not sure any of us will be able to help with. Folk Love writes via Bring Forth. This question has to do with what appears to be the declining birth rates across the globe. Do you think there is a metaphysical reason behind this, or are people simply unable to support a family due to the rising cost of living?
I do not know whether or not there's a metaphysical reason that the birth rate is declining. I do know that in addition to the reason of the cost of raising a family, and anyone responsible is going to look at that before committing to paying the bills through college for a child. I think that there is the simple truth that a lot of relationships never make it to the point where they want to have children together, and consequently, there are just fewer opportunities for children to come forth. There's no decline in lovemaking. There's a decline in lovemaking without protection.
I've got a theory about a possible metaphysical reason.
Yeah.
So we know that fourth density is basically coming. It's being imposed that we are evolving into fourth density beings, and with fourth density comes a social memory complex. And so the question comes about is, how does that social memory complex sort of form gradually within the social complex that humans have? And I always imagined that it would be sort of a gradual increase of intuition, that the social mind that a social memory complex draws upon will be more and more expressed through intuition and through individuals following their intuition and following their desires. And we also know that the social memory complex has sort of an innate connection with the actual planet that they're on. And we assume that given the population on Earth right now, that it is not a sustainable number of people, and that there is a significant less amount that could be sustained on Earth. So I would think that maybe if the social memory complex is being expressed more and more, then people might desire less to have kids, or they might decline to have kids out of simple social obligation because they feel they're supposed to, because they are more inclined to do what their intuition is telling them, to fulfill their desires to not have children, and that might be being fed by the social memory complex mind that is basically expressing itself, saying this population needs to be fewer for the Earth to support it. Like, our fourth density population cannot be supported, or 7 billion fourth density entities can't be supported on this planet, and so we need to naturally lessen that. And so maybe the desire to have children is appearing due to the need to have smaller population on Earth. And that's just the
Well, it's a certainly a good thought. And further to further that same kind of thinking, what if you want to have children, but you don't necessarily need to have them out of your loins, and you know how many orphans there are? Maybe you feel that the opportunities for orphans to have a supported life are desperate, and that you want to help. So you use your intuition in choosing the right, you know, children. But with that said, you find kids that you're, this kid is ours, you know. And I think that happens more than it used to.
I have nothing to contribute.
Well, Gary, are you planning on having kids at this point?
No.
Did you hear the force behind that?
Force density is working its ways on me. Jim, did you have a thought?
Very minor. I have fish in my ponds, and according to the size of the pond, the fish will determine how large the population gets and how large each fish gets. And I think if that's possible for fish and other creatures, there's probably an overriding tendency of the human being to also discover when we've got enough and when to cut back.
That's a great idea. Like this unconscious response to the environmental limitations.
Mm-hmm.
I've considered before, thought about how humanity seems to keep the balance between males and females being born, even though, you know, males are more prone to kill themselves in larger numbers, that there's some kind of I guess it would be the racial or planetary mind kind of coordinating that birth activity according to what is needed.
Right.
So, well, 1:55.
Do we want to say something about homecoming, maybe?
Yeah, we could talk about homecoming. On August 29 through 31, LL Research is holding its annual homecoming gathering. It's our big event of the year, and by big, that translates into 30 to tops 40 people, but big for us. People come from all over the country, and we get a few international visitors, and we meet here in Louisville, and we gather in a circle in the gardens that Jim and Carla have created. And we share our spirituality over the course of the weekend, Friday through Sunday, a spirituality that's grounded in the Law of One, of course. There's people who have been working with this information since, of course, the very beginning, and some people that have just discovered the book or just heard about it and don't know the first thing about it. The format is designed so that each person can have the opportunity to give a 30-minute presentation. Not everybody uses the time. Some come and more passively participate. Or if not passively, they don't give presentations. And during that 30 minutes, there is infinite room for creative expression. Some people have played music before. Some have, like myself, stared down at a paper and read it from minute 1 to minute 30. Some people have just asked questions of the group. We've done, I think we had a yoga session, 1:30 minute.
Yeah, Helen was here.
Yeah, it was Helen. And Eccles last year did some PowerPoints. Fox shared photos of her garden and talked about her life. So it's just really beautiful. Everybody opens up, and it's not a lecturer audience sort of setup, but everybody comes and shares, and the group respectfully listens. And it's people walk away from it feeling a sense of bonding. And often, in many cases, because people are isolated in their lives and they can't share with people, they come to something like homecoming and they just let loose. They finally have a venue and a medium where they can just be themselves and share what's on their hearts. And so there's a lot of like excited, buzzing energy, and it's a very loving experience. So more information about the logistics on the Bring Forth website, bringforth.org. And Carla, did you want to say goodbye to the group?
I do. Of course, we all love you dearly, every single one of you, no exception to that rule. And we love you all. And we love all the people at homecoming. But it's called homecoming because people feel like they're coming home. Simple as that. I mean, we're a place where everybody takes you in. Everybody trusts you. Everybody respects you. Everybody embraces you. And that's, the energy is a golden dome that I swear shoots to the heavens. By the end of the weekend, it's just incredible. And I love it beyond all things. I love that time of year.
I would add a quick caveat to that, and that's on the naming of homecoming. I 100% agree with Carla and follow through in the tradition that she and Jim created. About the home of the homecoming, that's not particular to Louisville or to LL Research, though we're in a unique position to facilitate that, but rather it's a function of a result of the seekers themselves, the people coming together and the quality of their interaction and the depth of their open heart creates that sense of home. So that can be anywhere on the planet, including Louisville. All right. To wrap it up, you've been listening to LL Research's In the Now, Q&A with Carla and crew. If you've enjoyed the show, please visit our websites, llresearch.org and bringforth.org. Thanks so much for listening, and a special thank you to those who submitted questions. If you would like to submit a question for us before the next show, please read the instructions on our page at blogtalkradio.com/LLResearch. Have a wonderful week, everybody. We'll be here next Wednesday at 1 p.m. Eastern, and we'll talk with you then.
I land on an island coast, and only so that I see a ghost. I run through a wooded aisle and chase the sunlight mile after mile. And I feel like I know this place as a tree line breaks in the wide open space. I stare at a bright red sun, search all day and never find anyone. Planets turn and the old stars